Chapter 13. Tom told him he was crazy to want to leave. For one thing, he pointed out, they were relatively safe here in the Atlantic Avenue Inn, especially with the elevators locked down and lobby access from the stairwell blocked off. This they had done by piling boxes and suitcases from the luggage room in front of the door at the end of the short corridor beyond the elevator banks. Even if someone of extraordinary strength were to push against that door from the other side, he'd only be able to shift the pile against the facing wall, creating a gap of maybe 6 inches, not enough to get through. For another, the tumult in the city beyond their little safe haven actually seemed to be increasing. There was a constant racket of conflicting alarms, shouts and screams, and racing engines, and sometimes the panic tang of smoke, although the day's brisk breeze seemed to be carrying the worst of that away from them. So far, Clay thought, but did not say aloud, at least not yet. He didn't want to frighten the girl any more than she already was. There were explosions that never seemed to come singly, but rather in spasms. One of those was so close that they all ducked, sure the front window would blow in. It didn't. But after that, they moved to Mr. Riccardi's inner sanctum. The third reason Tom gave for thinking Clay was crazy to even think about leaving the marginal safety of the inn was that it was now 5:15. The day would be ending soon. He argued that trying to leave Boston in the dark would be madness. "Just take a gander out there," he said, gesturing to Mr. Riccardi's little window, which looked out on Essex Street. Essex was crowded with abandoned cars. There was also at least one body, that of a young woman in jeans and a Red Sox sweatshirt. She lay face down on the sidewalk, both arms outstretched, as if she had died trying to swim. "Veritech," her sweatshirt proclaimed.
"Do you think you're going to drive your car? If you do, you better think again."
"He's right," Mr. Riccardi said. He was sitting behind his desk with his arms once more folded across his narrow chest, a study in gloom.
"You're in the Tamworth Street parking garage. I doubt if you'd even succeed in securing your keys."
Clay, who had already given his car up as a lost cause, opened his mouth to say he wasn't planning to drive, at least to start with, when another thump came from overhead, this one heavy enough to make the ceiling shiver. It was accompanied by the faint but distinctive shiver jingle of breaking glass. Alice Maxwell, who was sitting in the chair across the desk from Mr. Riccardi, looked up nervously, and then seemed to shrink further into herself.
"What's up there?" Tom asked. "It's the Iroquois room directly overhead," Mr. Riccardi replied. "The largest of our three meeting rooms, and where we keep all of our supplies. Chairs, tables, audio-visual equipment."
He paused.
"And although we have no restaurant, we arrange for buffets or cocktail parties, if clients request such service. That last thump..."
He didn't finish. As far as Clay was concerned, he didn't need to. That last thump had been a trolley, stacked high with glassware, being upended on the floor of the Iroquois room, where numerous other trolleys and tables had already been tipped over by some madman who was rampaging back and forth up there, buzzing around on the second floor like a bug trapped between the window and the screen, something without the wit to find a way out, something that could only run and break, run and break. Alice spoke up for the first time in nearly half an hour, and without prompting for the first time since they'd met her.
"You said something about someone named Doris?"
"Doris Gutierrez."
Mr. Riccardi was nodding.
"The head housekeeper. Excellent employee. Probably my best. She was on 3 the last time I heard from her."
"Did she have..."
Alice wouldn't say it. Instead, she made a gesture that had become almost as familiar to Clay as the index finger across the lips indicating, "Shh." Alice put her right hand to the side of her face with the thumb close to her ear, and the pinky in front of her mouth.
"No," Mr. Riccardi said, almost primly. "Employees have to leave them in their lockers while they're on the job. One violation gets them a reprimand. 2, and they can be fired. I tell them this when they're taken on."
He lifted one thin shoulder in a half shrug.
"It's management's policy, not mine."
"Would she have gone down to the second floor to investigate those sounds?"
Alice asked.
"Possibly," Mr. Riccardi said.
I have no way of knowing. I only know that I haven't heard from her since she reported the wastebasket fire out, and she hasn't answered her pages. I paged her twice.
Clay didn't want to say, "You see, it isn't safe here either," right out loud, so he looked past Alice at Tom, trying to give him the basic idea with his eyes. Tom said, "How many people would you say are still upstairs?"
"I have no way of knowing."
"If you had to guess?"
"Not many. As far as the housekeeping staff goes, probably just Doris. The day crew leaves at 3, and the night crew doesn't come on until 6.
Mr. Riccardi pressed his lips tightly together.
"It's an economy gesture. One cannot say measure because it doesn't work. As for guests..."
He considered.
"Afternoon is a slack time for us, very slack. Last night's guests have all checked out, of course. Checkout time at the Atlantic Inn is noon, and tonight's guests wouldn't begin checking in till 4 o'clock or so on an ordinary afternoon, which this most definitely is not. Guests staying several days are usually here on business, as I assume you were, Mr. Riddle."
Clay nodded without bothering to correct Riccardi on his name.
"At mid-afternoon, business people are usually out doing whatever it was that brought them to Boston. So you see, we have the place almost to ourselves."
As if to contradict this, there came another thump from above them, more shattering glass, and a faint, feral growl. They all looked up.
"Clay, listen," Tom said. "If the guy up there finds the stairs, I don't know if these people are capable of thought, but..."
"Judging by what we saw on the street," Clay said, "even calling them people might be wrong. I've got an idea that guy up there is more like a bug trapped between a window and a screen. A bug trapped like that might get out, if it found a hole. And the guy up there might find the stairs, but if he does, I think it'll be by accident."
"And when he gets down and finds the door to the lobby blocked, he'll use the fire door to the alley,"
Mr. Riccardi said with what was, for him, eagerness.
"We'll hear the alarm. It's rigged to ring when anyone pushes the bar, and we'll know he's gone. One less nut to worry about."
Somewhere south of them, something big blew up, and they all cringed. Clay supposed he now knew what living in Beirut during the 1980s had been like.
"I'm trying to make a point here," he said patiently.
"I don't think so," Tom said. "You're going anyway, because you're worried about your wife and son. You're trying to persuade us because you want company." Clay blew out a frustrated breath. "Sure I want company. But that's not why I'm trying to talk you into coming. The smell of smoke's stronger, but when's the last time you heard a siren?" None of them replied.
"Me either," Clay said. "I don't think things are going to get better in Boston. Not for a while. They're going to get worse."
"If it was the cell phones..."
"She tried to leave a message for Dad," Alice said.
She spoke rapidly, as if wanting to make sure she got all the words out before the memory flew away.
"She just wanted to make sure he'd pick up the dry cleaning because she needed her yellow wool dress for her committee meeting, and I needed my extra uni for the away game on Saturday. This was in the cab. And then we crashed. She choked the man, and she bit the man, and his turban fell off, and there was blood on the side of his face, and we crashed."
Alice looked around at their three staring faces, then put her own face in her hands and began to sob. Tom moved to comfort her. But Mr. Riccardi surprised Clay by coming around his desk and putting one pipe-stemmy arm around the girl before Tom could get to her.
"There, there," he said. "I'm sure it was all a misunderstanding, young lady."
She looked up at him, her eyes wide and wild.
"Misunderstanding?"
She indicated the dried bib of blood on the front of her dress.
"Does this look like a misunderstanding? I used the karate from the self-defense classes I took in junior high. I used karate on my own mother. I broke her nose, I think. I'm sure."
Alice shook her head rapidly, her hair flying.
"And still, if I hadn't been able to reach behind me and get the door open..."
"She would have killed you," Clay said flatly.
"She would have killed me,"
Alice agreed in a whisper.
"She didn't know who I was. My own mother."
She looked from Clay to Tom.
"It was the cell phones," she said in that same whisper. "It was the cell phones, all right."
Chapter 14. So how many of the damn things are there in Boston? Clay asked. What's the market penetration?
Given the large numbers of college students, I'd say it's got to be huge, Mr. Riccardi replied.
He had resumed his seat behind his desk, and now he looked a little more animated. Comforting the girl might have done it, or perhaps it was being asked a business-oriented question.
Although it goes much further than affluent young people, of course. I read an article in Inc. only a month or two ago that claimed there's now as many cell phones in mainland China as there are people in America. Can you imagine?
Clay didn't want to imagine. All right, Tom was nodding reluctantly. I see where you're going with this. Someone, some terrorist outfit, rigs the cell phone signal somehow. If you make a call or take one, you get some kind of, what? Some kind of a subliminal message, I guess, that makes you crazy. Sounds like science fiction, but I suppose 15 or 20 years ago, cell phones as they now exist would have seemed like science fiction to most people.
I'm pretty sure it's something like that, Clay said. You can get enough of it to screw you up righteously if you even overhear a call. He was thinking of Pixie Dark. But the insidious thing is that when people see things going wrong all around them, their first impulse is to reach for their cell phones and try to find out what's causing it, Tom said.
Yeah, Clay said. I saw people doing it. Tom looked at him bleakly.
So did I. What all this has to do with you leaving the safety of the hotel, especially with Doc coming on, I don't know, Mr. Riccardi said.
As if in answer, there came another explosion. It was followed by half a dozen more, marching off to the southeast like the diminishing footsteps of a giant. From above them came another thud and a faint cry of rage.
I don't think the crazy ones will have the brains to leave the city any more than that guy up there can find his way to the stairs, Clay said.
For a moment he thought the look on Tom's face was shock, and then he realized it was something else. Amazement, maybe, and dawning hope.
Oh, Christ, he said, and actually slapped the side of his face with one hand.
They won't leave. I never thought of that.
There might be something else, Alice said.
She was biting her lip and looking down at her hands, which were working together in a restless knot. She forced herself to look up at Clay.
It might actually be safer to go after dark.
Why's that, Alice?
If they can't see you, if you can get behind something, if you can hide, they forget about you almost right away.
What makes you think that, honey? Tom asked.
Because I hid from the man who was chasing me, she said in a low voice. The guy in the yellow shirt. This was just before I saw you. I hid in an alley, behind one of those dumpster thingies. I was scared because I thought there might not be any way back out if he came in after me, but it was all I could think of to do. I saw him standing at the mouth of the alley, looking around, walking around and around, walking the worry circle, my grandpa would say, and at first I thought he was playing with me, you know, because he had to have seen me go into the alley. I was only a few feet ahead of him, just a few feet, almost close enough to grab.
Alice began to tremble.
But once I was in there, it was like, I don't know.
Out of sight, out of mind, Tom said.
But if he was that close, why did you stop running?
Because I couldn't anymore, Alice said. I just couldn't. My legs were like rubber, and I felt like I was going to shake myself apart from the inside. But it turned out I didn't have to run anyway. He walked the worry circle a few more times, muttering that crazy talk, and then just walked off. I could hardly believe it. I thought he had been trying to fake me out, but at the same time I knew he was too crazy for anything like that.
She glanced briefly at Clay, then back down at her hands again.
My problem was running into him again. I should have stuck with you guys the first time. I can be pretty stupid sometimes.
You were scared, Clay began. And then the biggest explosion yet came from somewhere east of them, a deafening kerwham that made them all duck and cover their ears. They heard the window in the lobby shatter.
My God, Mr. Riccardi said.
His wide eyes underneath that bald head made him look to Clay like Little Orphan Annie's mentor, Daddy Warbucks.
That might have been the new Shell superstation they put in over on Neyland, the one all the taxis and the duck boats use. It was the right direction.
Clay had no idea if Riccardi was right. He He couldn't smell burning gasoline, at least not yet, but his visually trained mind's eye could see a triangle of city concrete now burning like a propane torch in the lightning day.
"Can a modern city burn?" he asked Tom. "One made mostly of concrete and metal and glass? Could it burn the way Chicago did after Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over the lantern?"
"That lantern-kicking business was nothing but an urban legend," Alice said.
She was rubbing the back of her neck as if she were getting a bad headache.
"Mrs. Meyer said so in American History."
"Sure it could," Tom said. "Look what happened to the World Trade Center after those airplanes hit it."
"Airplanes full of jet fuel," Mr. Riccardi said pointedly.
As if the bald desk clerk had conjured it, the smell of burning gasoline began to come to them, wafting through the shattered lobby windows and sliding beneath the door to the inner office like bad mojo.
"I guess you were on the nose about that Shell station," Tom remarked.
Mr. Riccardi went to the door between his office and the lobby. He unlocked it and opened it. What Clay could see of the lobby beyond already looked deserted and gloomy, and somehow irrelevant. Mr. Riccardi sniffed audibly, then closed the door and locked it again.
"Fainter already," he said.
"Wishful thinking," Clay said. "Either that or your nose is getting used to the aroma."
"I think he might be right," Tom said. "That's a good west wind out there, by which I mean the air's moving toward the ocean. And if what we just heard was that new station they put in on the corner of Neyland and Washington, by the New England Medical Center?"
"That's the one, all right," Mr. Riccardi said.
His face registered glum satisfaction.
"Oh, the protests! The smart money fixed that, believe you—"
Tom overrode him. "Then the hospital will be on fire by now, along with anybody left inside, of course."
"No,"
Alice said, then put a hand over her mouth.
"I think yes. And the Wang Center's next in line. The breeze may drop by full dark, but if it doesn't, everything east of the Mass Pike is apt to be so much toasted cheese by 10 p.m.
"We're west of there," Mr. Riccardi pointed out.
"Then we're safe enough," Clay said, "at least from that one." He went to Mr. Riccardi's little window, stood on his toes, and peered out onto Essex Street.
"What do you see?" Alice asked. "Do you see people?"
"No. Yes. One man, other side of the street."
"Is he one of the crazy ones?" she asked.
"I can't tell." But Clay thought he was. It was the way he ran, and the jerky way he kept looking back over his shoulder. Once, just before he went around the corner and onto Lincoln Street, the guy almost ran into a fruit display in front of a grocery store. And although Clay couldn't hear him, he could see the man's lips moving. "Now he's gone."
"No one else?" Tom asked.
"Not at the moment, but there's smoke." Clay paused. "Soot and ash, too. I can't tell how much. The wind's whipping it around."
"Okay, I'm convinced," Tom said. "I've always been a slow learner, but never a no-learner. The city's going to burn, and nobody's going to stand pat but the crazy people."
"I think that's right," Clay said. And he didn't think this was true of just Boston, but for the time being, Boston was all he could bear to consider. In time, he might be able to widen his view, but not until he knew Johnny was safe. Or maybe the big picture was always going to be beyond him. He drew small pictures for a living, after all. But in spite of everything, the selfish fellow who lived like a limpet on the underside of his mind had time to send up a clear thought. It came in colors of blue and dark, sparkling gold.
"Why did it have to happen today, of all days? Just after I finally made a solid strike."
"Can I come with you guys, if you go?"
Alice asked. "Sure," Clay said. He looked at the desk clerk. "You can too, Mr. Riccardi."
"I shall stay at my post," Mr. Riccardi said.
He spoke loftily, but before they shifted away from Clay's, his eyes looked sick.
"I don't think you'll get in Dutch with the management for locking up and leaving under these circumstances," Tom said.
He spoke in the gentle fashion Clay was so much coming to like.
"I shall stay at my post," he said again. "Mr. Donnelly, the day manager, went out to make the afternoon deposit at the bank and left me in charge. If he comes back, perhaps then—"
"Please, Mr. Riccardi," Alice said. "Staying here is no good."
But Mr. Riccardi, who had once more crossed his arms over his thin chest, only shook his head. Chapter 15. They moved one of the Queen Anne chairs aside, and Mr. Riccardi unlocked the front doors for them. Clay looked out. He could see no people moving in either direction, but it was hard to tell for sure because the air was now full of fine, dark ash. It danced in the breeze like black snow. "Come on," he said. They were only going next door to start with, to the Metropolitan Cafe.
"I'm going to relock the door and put the chair back in place," Mr. Riccardi said, "but I'll be listening. If you run into trouble, if there are more of those people hiding in the Metropolitan, for instance, and you have to retreat, just remember to shout, 'Mr. Riccardi, Mr. Riccardi, we need you.' That way I'll know it's safe to open the door. Is that understood?"
"Yes," Clay said. He squeezed Mr. Riccardi's thin shoulder. The desk clerk flinched, then stood firm, although he showed no particular sign of pleasure at being so saluted.
"You're all right. I didn't think you were, but I was wrong." "I hope I do my best," the bald man said stiffly. "Just remember."
"We'll remember," Tom said. "And we'll be over there maybe 10 minutes. If anything goes wrong over here, you give a shout."
"All right."
But Clay didn't think he would. He didn't know why he thought that. It made no sense to think a man wouldn't give a shout to save himself if he was in trouble. But Clay did think it.
Alice said, "Please change your mind, Mr. Riccardi. It's not safe in Boston, you must know that by now."
Mr. Riccardi only looked away, and Clay thought, not without wonder,
"This is how a man looks when he's deciding that the risk of death is better than the risk of change."
"Come on," Clay said. "Let's make some sandwiches while we've still got electricity to see by."
"Some bottled water wouldn't hurt either," Tom said.
Chapter 16. The electricity failed, just as they were wrapping the last of their sandwiches in the Metropolitan Cafe's tidy, white-tiled little kitchen. By then, Clay had tried 3 more times to get through to Maine, once to his old house, once to Kent Pond Elementary, where Sharon taught, and once to Joshua Chamberlain Middle School, which Johnny now attended. In no case did he get farther than Maine's 207 area code. When the lights in the Metropolitan went out, Alice screamed in what at first seemed to Clay like total darkness. Then the emergency lights came on, glare bright. Alice was not much comforted. She was clinging to Tom with one arm. In the other, she was brandishing the bread knife she'd used to cut the sandwiches with. Her eyes were wide and somehow flat, shocked.
"Alice, put that knife down," Clay said, a little more sharply than he'd intended,
"before you cut one of us with it."
"Or yourself," Tom said in that mild and soothing voice of his.
His spectacles glinted in the glare of the emergency lights. She put it down, then promptly picked it up again.
"I want it," she said. "I want to take it with me. You have one, Clay. I want one."
"All right," he said, "but you don't have a belt. We'll make you one from a tablecloth. For now, just be careful." Half the sandwiches were roast beef and cheese, half ham and cheese. Alice had wrapped them in saran wrap. Under the cash register, Clay found a stack of sacks with doggy bag written on one side and people bag written on the other. He and Tom tumbled the sandwiches into a pair of these. Into a third bag, they put 3 bottles of water. The tables had been made up for a dinner service that was never going to happen. 2 or 3 had been tumbled over, but most stood perfect, with their glasses and silver shining in the hard light of the emergency boxes on the walls. Something about their calm orderliness hurt Clay's heart. The cleanliness of the folded napkins and the little electric lamps on each table. Those were now dark, and he had an idea it might be a long time before the bulbs inside lit up again. He saw Alice and Tom gazing about with faces as unhappy as his felt, and a desire to cheer them up, almost manic in its urgency, came over him. He remembered a trick he used to do for his son. He wondered again about Johnny's cell phone, and the panic rat took another nip out of him.
Clay hoped with all his heart the damned phone was lying forgotten under Johnny G's bed, among the dust kitties, with its battery flat, flat, flat.
"Watch this carefully," he said, setting his bag of sandwiches aside, "and please note that at no time do my hands leave my wrists." He grasped the hanging skirt of a tablecloth.
"This is hardly the time for parlor tricks," Tom said. "I want to see."
Alice said. For the first time since they'd met her, there was a smile on her face. It was small, but it was there.
We need the tablecloth, Clay said. It won't take a second. And besides, the lady wants to see.
He turned to Alice. But you have to say a magic word. Shazam will do.
Shazam, she said,
and Clay pulled briskly with both hands. He hadn't done the trick in 2, maybe even 3 years, and it almost didn't work. And yet at the same time, his mistake, some small hesitation in the pull, no doubt, actually added to the charm of the thing. Instead of staying where they were while the tablecloth magically disappeared from beneath them, all the place settings on the table moved about 4 inches to the right. The glass nearest to where Clay was standing actually wound up with its circular base half on and half off the table. Alice applauded, now laughing. Clay took a bow with his hands held out.
"Can we go now, O great vermicelli?" Tom asked, but even Tom was smiling.
Clay could see his small teeth in the emergency lights. "Soon as I rig this," Clay said. "She can carry the knife on one side and a bag of sandwiches on the other. You can tote the water." He folded the tablecloth over into a triangle shape, then rolled it quickly into a belt. He slipped a bag of sandwiches onto this by the bag's carrier handles, then put the tablecloth around the girl's slim waist, having to take a turn and a half and tie the knot in back to make the thing secure. He finished by sliding the serrated bread knife home on the right side.
"Say, you're pretty handy," Tom said.
"Handy is dandy," Clay said. And then something else blew up outside, close enough to shake the cafe. The glass that had been standing half on and half off the table lost its balance, tumbled to the floor, and shattered. The three of them looked at it. Clay thought to tell them he didn't believe in omens, but that would only make things worse. Besides, he did. Chapter 17. Clay had his reasons for wanting to go back to the Atlantic Avenue Inn before they set off. One was to retrieve his portfolio, which he'd left sitting in the lobby. Another was to see if they couldn't find some sort of makeshift scabbard for Alice's knife. He reckoned even a shaving kit would do, if it was long enough. A third was to give Mr. Riccardi another chance to join them. He was surprised to find he wanted this even more than he wanted the forgotten portfolio of drawings. He had taken an odd, reluctant liking to the man. When he confessed this to Tom, Tom surprised him by nodding.
"It's the way I feel about anchovies on pizza," he said. "I tell myself there's something disgusting about a combination of cheese, tomato sauce, and dead fish. But sometimes that shameful urge comes over me, and I can't stand against it."
A blizzard of black ash and soot was blowing up the street and between the buildings. Car alarms warbled, burglar alarms brayed, and fire alarms clanged. There seemed to be no heat in the air, but Clay could hear the crackle of fire to the south and east of them. The smell of burning was stronger, too. They heard voices shouting, but these were to the southwest, back toward the common, where Boylston Street widened. When they got next door to the Atlantic Avenue Inn, Tom helped Clay push one of the Queen Anne chairs away from one of the broken glass door panels. The lobby beyond was now a pool of gloom in which Mr. Riccardi's desk and the sofa were only darker shadows. If Clay hadn't already been in there, he would have had no idea what those shadows represented. Above the elevators, a single emergency light guttered, the boxed battery beneath it buzzing like a horsefly.
"Mr. Riccardi?" Tom called. "Mr. Riccardi, we came back to see if you changed your mind."
There was no reply. After a moment, Alice began carefully to knock out the glass teeth that still jutted from the window frame.
"Mr. Riccardi!"
Tom called again, and when there was still no answer, he turned to Clay.
"You're going in there, are you?"
"Yes, to get my portfolio. It's got my drawings in it."
"You don't have copies?"
"Those are the originals," Clay said, as if this explained everything. To him it did. And besides, there was Mr. Riccardi. He'd said, "I'll be listening."
"What if Thumper from upstairs got him?"
Tom asked. "If that had happened, I think we'd have heard him thumping around down here," Clay said. "For that matter, he would have come running at the sound of our voice, babbling like the guy who tried to carve us up back by the common."
"You don't know that," Alice said. She was gnawing at her lower lip. It's way too early for you to think you know all the rules.
Of course she was right, but they couldn't stand around here discussing it. That was no good either. I'll be careful, he said, and put a leg over the bottom of the window. It was narrow, but plenty wide enough for him to climb through. I'll just poke my head into his office. If he's not there, I won't go hunting around for him like a chick in a horror movie. I'll just grab my portfolio and we'll boogie.
Keep yelling, Alice said. Just say, okay, I'm okay, something like that, the whole time.
All right. But if I stop yelling, just go. Don't come in after me.
Don't worry, she said, unsmiling. I saw all those movies, too. We've got Cinemax.
Chapter 18.
I'm okay, Clay shouted, picking up his portfolio and then putting it down on the reception desk.
Good to go, he thought, but not quite yet. He looked over his shoulder as he went around the desk and saw the one unblocked window glimmering, seeming to float in the thickening gloom, with two silhouettes cut into the day's last light.
I'm okay, still okay. Just going in to check his office now. Still okay. Clay?
Tom's voice was clearly alarmed, but for a moment Clay couldn't respond and set Tom's mind at rest. There was an overhead light fixture in the middle of the inner office's high ceiling. Mr. Riccardi was hanging from it by what looked like a drape cord. A white bag was pulled down over his head. Clay thought it was the kind of plastic bag the hotel gave you to put your dirty laundry and dry cleaning in.
Clay, are you all right?
Clay?
Alice sounded shrill, ready to be hysterical.
Okay,
he heard himself say. His mouth seemed to be operating itself, with no help from his brain.
Still right here.
He was thinking of how Mr. Riccardi had looked when he said, I shall stay at my post. The words had been lofty, but the eyes had been scared and somehow humble. The eyes of a small raccoon driven into a corner of the garage by a large and angry dog.
I'm coming out now.
He backed away, as if Mr. Riccardi might slip his homemade drape cord noose and come after him the second he turned his back. He was suddenly more than afraid for Sharon and Johnny. He was homesick for them, with a depth of feeling that made him think of his first day at school, his mother leaving him at the playground gate. The other parents had walked their kids inside, but his mother said, You just go in there, Clayton. It's the first room. You'll be fine. Boys should do this part alone. Before he did what she told him, he had watched her going away, back up Cedar Street, her blue coat. Now, standing here in the dark, he was renewing acquaintance with the knowledge that the second part of homesick was sick for a reason. Tom and Alice were fine, but he wanted the people he loved. Once he was around the reception desk, he faced the street and crossed the lobby. He got close enough to the long, broken window to see the frightened faces of his new friends, then remembered he had forgotten his fucking portfolio again and had to go back. Reaching for it, he felt certain that Mr. Riccardi's hand would steal out of the gathering darkness behind the desk and close over his. That didn't happen, but from overhead came another of those thumps. Something still up there. Something still blundering around in the dark. Something that had been human until 3 o'clock this afternoon. This time, when he was halfway to the door, the lobby's single battery-powered emergency light stuttered briefly, then went out. That's a fire code violation, Clay thought. I ought to report that. He handed out his portfolio. Tom took it.
Where is he? Alice asked. Wasn't he there?
Dead, Clay said. It had crossed his mind to lie, but he didn't think he was capable. He was too shocked by what he had seen.
How did a man hang himself?
He didn't see how it was even possible. Suicide. Alice began to cry, and it occurred to Clay that she didn't know that if it had been up to Mr. Riccardi,
she'd probably be dead herself now.
The thing was, he felt a little like crying himself, because Mr. Riccardi had come around. Maybe most people did, if they got a chance. From west of them on the darkening street, back toward the common, came a scream that seemed too great to have issued from human lungs. It sounded to Clay almost like the trumpeting of an elephant. There was no pain in it, and no joy. There was only madness. Alice cringed against him, and he put an arm around her. The feel of her body was like the feel of an electrical wire with a strong current passing through it.
"If we're going to get out of here, let's do it," Tom said. "If we don't run into too much trouble, we should be able to get as far north as Malden and spend the night at my place."
"That's a hell of a good idea," Clay said. Tom smiled cautiously.
"You really think so?"
"I really do. Who knows? Maybe Officer Ashland's already there."
"Who's Officer Ashland?" Alice asked.
"A policeman we met back by the common," Tom said. "He, you know, helped us out." The three of them were now walking east toward Atlantic Avenue, through the falling ash and the sound of alarms.
"We won't see him, though. Clay's just trying to be funny."
"Oh," she said. "I'm glad somebody's trying to be." Lying on the pavement by a litter barrel was a blue cell phone with a cracked casing. Alice kicked it into the gutter without breaking stride.
"Good one," Clay said.
Alice shrugged.
5 years of soccer," she said.
And at that moment, the streetlights came on, like a promise that all was not yet lost. Malden. Chapter 1. Thousands of people stood on the Mystic River Bridge and watched as everything between Com Ave and Boston Harbor took fire and burned. The wind from the west remained brisk and warm even after the sun was down, and the flames roared like a furnace, blotting out the stars. The rising moon was full and ultimately hideous. Sometimes the smoke masked it, but all too often that bulging dragon's eye swam free and peered down, casting a bleary orange light. Clay thought it a horror comic moon, but didn't say so. No one had much to say. The people on the bridge only looked at the city they had so lately left, watching as the flames reached the pricey harborfront condos and began engulfing them. From across the water came an interwoven tapestry of alarms, fire alarms and car alarms mostly, with several whooping sirens added for spice. For a while, an amplified voice had told citizens to get off the streets, and then another had begun advising them to leave the city on foot by major arteries west and north. These two contradictory pieces of advice had competed with each other for several minutes, and then get off the streets had ceased. About 5 minutes later, leave the city on foot had also quit. Now there was only the hungry roar of the wind-driven fire, the alarms, and a steady low crumping sound that Clay thought must be windows imploding in the enormous heat. He wondered how many people had been trapped over there, trapped between the fire and the water.
"Remember wondering if a modern city could burn?" Tom McCourt said.
In the light of the fire, his small, intelligent face looked tired and sick. There was a smudge of ash on one of his cheeks.
"Remember that?"
"Shut up, come on," Alice said. She was clearly distraught, but like Tom, she spoke in a low voice.
"It's like we're in a library," Clay thought. And then he thought, "No, a funeral home." "Can't we please go, because this is kicking my ass?"
"Sure," Clay said, "you bet. How far to your place, Tom?"
"From here? Less than 2 miles," he said. "But it's not all behind us, I'm sorry to say."
They had turned north now, and he pointed ahead and to the right. The glow blooming there could almost have been orange-tinted arc-sodium streetlights on a cloudy night, except the night was clear, and the streetlights were now out. In any case, streetlights did not give off rising columns of smoke. Alice moaned, then covered her mouth as if she expected someone among the silent multitude watching Boston burn might reprimand her for making too much noise.
"Don't worry," Tom said with eerie calm. "We're going to Malden, and that looks like Revere. The way the wind's blowing, Malden should still be all right."
"Stop right there," Clay urged him silently, but Tom did not.
"For now,"
he added. Chapter 2. There were several dozen abandoned cars on the lower deck of the span, and a fire truck with East Boston lettered on its avocado green side that had been sideswiped by a cement truck. Both were abandoned. But mostly this level of the bridge belonged to the pedestrians. Except now you probably have to call them refugees, Clay thought, and then realized there was no them about it. Us. Call us refugees. There was still very little talk. Most people just stood and watched the city burn in silence. Those who were moving went slowly, looking back frequently over their shoulders. Then, as they neared the far end of the bridge, he could see Old Ironsides, at least he thought it was Old Ironsides, riding at anchor in the harbor, still safe from the flames. He noticed an odd thing. Many of them were also looking at Alice. At first, he had the paranoid idea that people must think he and Tom had abducted the girl and were spiriting her away for God knew what immoral purposes. Then he had to remind himself that these wraiths on the Mystic Bridge were in shock, even more uprooted from their normal lives than the Hurricane Katrina refugees had been. Those unfortunates had at least had some warning, and were unlikely to be capable of considering such fine ideas. Most were too deep in their own heads for moralizing. Then the moon rose a little higher and came out a little more strongly, and he got it. She was the only adolescent in sight. Even Clay himself was young compared to most of their fellow refugees. The majority of people gawking at the torch that had been Boston, or plodding slowly toward Malden and Danvers, were over 40, and many looked eligible for the Golden Ager discount at Denny's. He saw a few people with little kids, and a couple of babies in strollers, but that was pretty much it for the younger set. A little farther on, he noticed something else. There were cell phones, lying discarded in the roadway. Every few feet they passed another one, and none were whole. They had either been run over, or stomped down to nothing but wire and splinters of plastic, like dangerous snakes that had been destroyed before they could bite again. Chapter 3
"What's your name, dear?"
asked a plump woman who came angling across to their side of the highway. This was about 5 minutes after they had left the bridge. Tom said another 15 would bring them to the Salem Street exit, and from there it was only 4 blocks to his house. He said his cat would be awfully glad to see him, and that had brought a wan smile to Alice's face. Clay thought wan was better than nothing. Now Alice looked with reflexive mistrust at the plump woman who had detached herself from the mostly silent groups and little lines of men and women, hardly more than shadows, really, some with suitcases, some carrying shopping bags or wearing backpacks, that had crossed the Mystic and were walking north on Route 1, away from the Great Fire to the south, and all too aware of the new one taking hold in Revere, off to the northeast. The plump woman looked back at her with sweet interest. Her graying hair was done in neat, beauty shop curls. She wore cat's eye glasses, and what Clay's mother would have called a car coat. She carried a shopping bag in one hand and a book in the other. There seemed to be no harm in her. She certainly wasn't one of the phone crazies. They hadn't seen a single one of those since leaving the Atlantic Avenue Inn with their sacks of grub. But Clay felt himself go on point, just the same.
To be approached as if they were at a get-acquainted tea instead of fleeing a burning city
didn't seem normal. But under these circumstances, just what was? He was probably losing it. But if so, Tom was too. He was also watching the plump, motherly woman with go-away eyes.